The woman squinted, held the gun higher.
Don't be stupid, she said.
I tried to shrug congenially, an ignorant stranger, if it was possible to be congenial under the circumstances. The woman was more than suspicious. She had been through hell, and it took some strength of character, or some deep reluctance to add to the carnage, to keep from pulling the trigger and killing me, if only to avoid having to think.
I haven't heard of Calder's zone in years, she said. It gave in to Elizabeth's zone. They sexed and fluxed when I was a child.
Years had passed, perhaps decades. My information was seriously out of date. Are you a biologist? I asked. She did not seem so tired or unskilled that her bullets would miss, and I had none of my medical machinery to save me if the gun did tear me open, not even a memory pack to store my thoughts and personality.
I'm no biologist, and neither are you, the woman said. You don't even talk like anyone I know. Why do you call it a forest?
Her eyes glittered in the lamplight. The gun barrel dropped a few centimeters.
But I don't think you're a Bryanist. You said you've been in the Silva out there a long time?
2 years.
Studying?
I nodded.
A researcher?
I hope to become one.
You didn't fight when they came?
I didn't see it. I didn't know it was happening.
The best ones fought. You're a coward. You stayed in the Silva.
She shook her head slowly.
That's my cousin, Gennadia.
She pointed a shaky finger at the nearest of the corpses.
And that's Johann, her husband. That's Naquano, the village synthesist. Janos went to Calcutta and then crossed to Naderville to join the Bryanists. He left me here.
She rubbed her nose and inspected the back of her hand.
He told them we had magnesium and tin and copper and some iron. They came to see. Janos came back with them. He wouldn't even look at me. We told them they would have to consult with Abel Link.
I thought perhaps Link had had a son, until I realized by her intonation that the first name was an honorific.
They said we could not refuse them. They took our radios. They said Bayes had his orders. The mayor told them to leave. They killed the mayor, and some of the men tried to fight. They killed all except me. I hid in the Silva. They'll come back soon and take over everything.
She laughed with girlish glee.
I'm a coward, too. Not much left.
Terrible, I said. Naquano. That name had been on the list. I had once met the scholar named Naquano, a devout Naderite student who had studied under my uncle. She picked up the lantern and raised it above her head, stepping closer. She shined the fitful beam on my clothes.
You've only been in the Silva a few hours. Elizabeth covers all visitors with her dust, but the boats left days ago. You're hardly black at all.
Her eyes burned.
Are you real?
I bathed in the river, I said. She issued a half-whine, half-laugh, raised the gun as if to fire into the air, and pulled the trigger. The hammer fell on an empty chamber. Then she released the gun, letting it dangle from one finger before it fell to the boards with a heavy thump. She dropped to her knees.
I don't care, she said. I just as soon die. The whole world is a lie now. We've made it a lie.
With a shudder, she lay down, curling up her arms and legs into a fetal ball, and abruptly closed her eyes. I stood for a while, heart thumping, mouth dry, uncertain where to begin. Finally, with a jerk, I walked over to the woman and knelt beside her. She seemed to be asleep. My breath came fast from having the gun held on me. This proof of my weakness, nearly dying within a few minutes of my arrival, made me angry at myself, at everything. Teeth clenched, I picked up the gun, slipped it into my waistband, and stepped around her to examine the bodies. 2 men and a woman. I found the smell unfamiliar and offensive. I had never smelled dead bodies undergoing natural decay, except in entertainments and training. Conflict with the jarts in the way did not have such crudities. I suspected the decay had progressed in unfamiliar ways. No external bacteria, I thought, only internal, and those carefully selected centuries ago for the populations of Thistledown. A peculiarly artificial and unnatural way to return to the soil, if Lamarckia could be said to have soil. With a shudder, I bent over to examine Naquano first. A tall, dark-skinned male, face almost unrecognizable. But in the discolored features I saw a resemblance to the young vital student who had worked with my father's brother in Alexandria. But this man was much older than the Naquano I knew would have been. The hastily opened gate had pushed me decades along Lamarckia's world line. For a long moment I could only stare, all my thoughts in confusion. Then I steeled myself and searched through the corpse's pockets. I found a few coins and a thin pouch containing paper money, a small, elegantly tooled slate, and a stale piece of bread wrapped up in waxy paper. I examined the money, then returned it to the corpse. Devaricates preferred 20th-century modes of economic exchange. In my own pocket I carried some money copied from samples provided by the informer. The money bore little resemblance to that which I found on Naquano. More than likely it would be useless here. I could not bring myself to steal money from corpses. The slate was another matter. I needed information desperately. I slipped it into my pants pocket. I sat beside the sleeping woman, thinking. The breeze had died to nothing, and the blunt, sweet stink of death hung in the air. I closed my eyes, pinched my nose against the smell. Jan Fima had said he was part of a faction opposed to Lenk's policies. This faction regretted Lenk's decision to migrate illegally with limited resources and foresaw much trouble in the future. Apparently the trouble had begun. Perhaps it had been going on for some time. Jan Fima had supposed there would be an individual in Moonrise who would have supplies and information for a Nexus representative. But how patient an individual! I cursed under my breath and rubbed my eyes. Two small moons rose within the hour, each a quarter of a degree wide, and chased each other slowly overhead. Their light threw mercurial roads across the river's smooth currents. Large, dark humps rose in the river, several dozen meters from the bank. Moonlight danced around them in ghostly sparkles. I did not know what the humps were. Your ignorance will kill you. And here, it could all really end. The woman slept soundly, like a child, breath even and shallow, with occasional twitches and grumbles. I was reluctant to leave her, but there did not appear to be any more trouble in the offing. I could not let her stay on the dock, however. I lifted her and carried her away from the corpses, laying her gently on the soft dirt adjacent to the landing. I took off my coat and made a pillow for her. She grumbled faintly, twitched, and settled onto the cushion, gripping the folded coat with long, dirty fingers. You had it all, and it wasn't enough. Restless, searching, you threw it all away. You went to the Geshels, gravitated to their power, begged for assignments, glory of fighting the Jarts. Then they sent you here. A grand assignment, Janosch told you, an entire world and all the glory yours. But a kind of oubliette, a mere sideslip in one's career. To shut up the whining voice, I pulled Naquano's slate from my pocket. It was an anachronism, a late 20th-century design favored by the Devaricates, who shunned all later technology. I sat. The illuminated screen cast a glow across my face, remarkably similar to that from the moons above. Searching the memory, I found a number of Naquano's personal files, some of them extensive, but all locked. I searched through the library on the slate, and found a directory with files created on Lamarckia, dated by a calendar established after the immigration. A scholar named Redhill had begun a fairly extensive local encyclopedia, and I was able to learn much about this part of Lamarckia in the space of an hour. Reading and scrolling and playing back videos, I lost myself in new knowledge, and my confidence began to return. 37 Lamarckian years had passed since the arrival of the immigrants. The gatekeepers had been off more than they knew. It was possible I could never return to the Way, even if I located the other clavicle, and that no one in the Way could ever find Lamarckia through the stack again. The humps in the river sank with soft gurgling sounds. The encyclopedia called them river vines and said they were intrusions from Zone 5. Patane's zone, scions of another ecos. The river was only lightly utilized by Zone 1, Elizabeth's zone, which apparently did not like riparian or pelagic environments. So much to learn. I searched with an inward lick of thought for the elements that had once enhanced and accelerated my mind. The gaps left by their removal felt like missing limbs, still having a kind of phantom presence. I kept darting back and forth between exhilaration and fear, amounting to despair that I would fail. In my dread lurked a strong sexual need. My erection seemed more than inappropriate in these surroundings. With the smell of decay, such a response struck me as obscene. I frowned and quelled the impulse. Others had spoken of danger arousing such reactions. No reason yet to be ashamed. With a few minutes to calm down, I felt my confidence return. I had been well trained and well educated for this mission. Using what the informer knew, I had created an inference map of talents necessary to survive and travel on Lamarckia. Technologies, attitudes, language shifts. But no one had expected slaughter or wholesale war. A fine mist crossed the river, out of place in these conditions. I realized after a moment that the mist was a scented aerosol, not just water vapor. Something in the ecos conveying information to something else. I visualized all of Zone 1, all of Elizabeth, as an organic processor, a vast sensate organizer, not quite as primitive as a hive, not as swift and connected as a mind, but aware of all its tiny forms, sending them messages on chemical winds, a huge mother directing many billions of children. Redhill brought me up to date on what progress had been made in Lamarckian studies in almost 4 decades. The encyclopedia postulated that life had first arisen on Lamarckia 300 million years ago. The star was young, barely 4 billion years old. The planet still retained a great deal of primordial heat, which supplemented the star's relatively weak insulation. On all of Lamarckia, only 109 genetically different organisms had been discovered, all Ekoi, 7 of them on Elizabeth's land. Ekoi in the different zones rarely preyed on scions of other Ekoi, but frequently observed and copied, or captured them for more detailed study. The Ekoi sent swift samplers, sometimes called spies or thieves, flying or running or swimming scions, to recover and return bites of tissue or whole scions. If the designs were found useful, the Ekoi incorporated them, modifying some or all of their own scions, or replacing them with new forms. Observed, stolen, copied, as well as inherited traits were passed on to subsequent generations. Inheritance of acquired traits, a largely discredited theory of Earth's evolution, had been postulated almost 900 years ago by the French biologist Jean-Baptiste de Lamarck. So the original surveyors had given his name to the planet. When the immigrants had first arrived, Elizabeth's silva had been mostly orange and gray. The encyclopedia said that an ecos could flux or alter much of its character suddenly in as little time as 2 days and without warning. During a flux, many if not all types of scions were absorbed and recycled into scions with new designs. This had last happened in Zone 2 28 years before, as the woman had said. Calder's zone had sexed, become receptive to a complete genetic merger. Elizabeth's zone had accepted this proposal. The two had merged, and all of the scions of both Ekoi had been recalled. The new single ecos had then fluxed, recreating itself. This had been a time of extraordinary hardship for the immigrants. Elizabeth's zone had dominated, taken over Calder's zone, and now occupied a stretch of Elizabeth's land from the center to the northern coast, 2,000 kilometers at its widest extent east to west, where it met with other zones, 3, 4, 5, and now 6, denuded truce lines formed stark white barriers like lines on a map. Altogether, 5 zones now covered the continent of Elizabeth's land. In the south, I learned, a group of large islands filled a crowded sea bounded by Cape Magellan, and on these islands, Zones 3 and 4 divided territories, with one island occupied by a much smaller zone, little explored, and called simply Zone 7. Zone 5, called Pétain's Zone, lay east of Elizabeth's Zone and along the eastern coast. It was an adapted pelagic, an ocean-going zone that had adapted to land perhaps a million years before. Few zones occupied large areas of both land and water. It was Zone 5's huge vines that rose three times a day from the river that flowed past moonrise. I pinched the bridge of my nose and shut off the slate. I had used these primitive displays in training and had become proficient, but they still hurt my eyes. After a few minutes, listening to the lapping of the river against the piles of the pier and the woman's steady breathing, I returned to the slate again. I found a citizen's list, 2 years old, and searched for the village of Moonrise, found the woman's picture, and connected it with a name. Larissa Cashamu, born to Sirs Hakim Cashamu and Belinda Bichon Cashamu, 32 Lamarckian years ago. Married into the Strick triad. Janos Strick, husband. In Devaricate society, and in most Orthodox Naderite arrangements, triad families did not exchange mates. Monogamy was the rule, but families shared finances and the raising of children. Larissa Strick Cashamu was in fact not much older than I. Stress and disaster had made her seem ancient. I slipped the slate into my pants pocket and took the woman's lantern. Time to find out what had happened in Moonrise. Time to begin this work, however unpleasant. 2. The road from the dock was irregularly paved with stones and gravel. Fresh, broad-tread wheel tracks had been cut into the roadbed, making a mess of the gravel. Twisted scraps of mud on the dock could have fallen from tire treads. I concluded that someone had moved large equipment down the road and onto the dock. Shining the light across the silva, I noticed holes and splintered gouges in the trunks of a few arborids near the road. Poking my finger a few centimeters into one hole, I felt a hard object at its bottom. A bullet. I looked back at the bodies on the landing, trying to put all this evidence together. I dismissed the possibility that Larissa had killed the people on the dock. For the moment, that made no sense at all. The only other conclusion possible was that shots had been fired from boats on the river. Narrow pipes mounted on iron rods lined the road. I bent to examine the pipes, felt a moisture dripping from their lower halves. Tiny holes pierced the pipes, pointing outward toward the silva. I sniffed a drop on my finger. The fluid in the pipes was redolent with a sour skunkiness. I guessed that the pipes sprayed something the scions found unpleasant, one way to keep the roads and village from being overgrown, or invaded. Something large and indistinct stirred trunks and made gentle sucking sounds in the undergrowth. Against the bright stars, two long, sinuous arms, or necks, rose black against the trees, plucking at the parasols and fans. Not grazing, but wiping with long, shushing sounds, and pruning with quick snicks of faintly luminous blue teeth. I raised the lantern high, but the unfocused beam revealed little. Each arm rose from a dark central body and extended 6 or 7 meters above my head. The hole was as large as two adult giraffes. I picked up my pace, again feeling my arm hairs prickle. The road broadened, and then ran up against a round tower of ochre stone rising above the silva. The road split and skirted the edge of a clearing beyond. In the clearing sat the center of the village of Moonrise. Twin two-story square stone buildings with peaked slate roofs like dormitories flanked a quadrangle north of the tower. I crossed the square, shining the broad, dim beam right and left. More bodies lay on the square. In the middle, I paused beside one of the bodies, a woman, age uncertain, a bullet through her forehead. In the square, which covered perhaps a quarter hectare, I grimly counted 22 bodies. They had all been shot with low-caliber kinetic weapons, guns somewhat less powerful than the one now tucked in my waistband. I stood in the middle of the square, working to stay calm. Gentle wind and the rhythmic creaking of a door. Cool, moist air. Bodies. Silence. Bright double arc of star clouds and spray of brighter stars gave me a moment of giddy vertigo. I controlled that quickly, but found the burn of anger less easy to snuff. away from centuries of culture and political experience, away from all restraints and the enforced patterns of tens of millions of fellow citizens, the immigrants had reverted. The old human pattern of violent conflict had started again. But my instructions did not include salvation for the Devaricate immigrants. Lamarckia was my main concern. I didn't come here to get involved in a stupid war. I crossed the quadrangle diagonally and reached the north end of the closest dormitory. I climbed the steps quietly and peered into the open door. My fingers felt the door's strong, smooth-grained material as I waved the lantern at the dark and empty hall beyond. In Red Hill's encyclopedia, Zone 1's most common trees were called Lisbu, Elizabeth's bamboo. The door was made from xyla, the immigrant word for woody material taken from arborids. In this case, of Lisbu trunk sheet, unwound from the spiral growth. One could simply fell the trunk, lop off the crown and low-growth parasols, grab the edge of Lisbu in one's hands, and unwind it. I shook my head. Old habits, mind happily displaying fresh knowledge like a shield. I entered the building and searched, not for bodies, though I found 12 more of those, but for information. The buildings had been fully wired and had electric lights. I looked through desks and chests of drawers, carefully replacing everything. I picked through the pockets and belongings of the corpses, grimacing at the ghoulish task, hoping to find more slates. I found none. Robbing corpses had not been specified in my instructions, but it was not entirely dishonorable under the circumstances. On the second floor, I entered the mayor's office and found a primitive message board covered with village records, charts for monoculture crop growth and harvest yields, a chart of the village's population over the last 20 years, pegged at its highest 150 in the last year, and a map of the village. I touched the thorn-like pins holding the map and saw that another more recent map had been torn off, leaving corners. The older map, heavily penciled, had been revealed. I emerged from the building and looked at the dark sky. Clouds had sailed in, thin parallel lines of irregular fluff high across the stars. Both moons were down. It would be dawn soon. Before searching the next dormitory, I walked to the greenhouses and fields farther north, beyond the water plant. Two white ceramic pipes carried water from the river to the plant where it was filtered, but not boiled or otherwise treated. Lamarckia had no indigenous microbes that would bother humans. Human-carried microbes, the few that had survived purging and translation to thistledown, seemed not to thrive on Lamarckia. The biological niches were either too restricted or already occupied. The power plant employed simple technologies. 2 hectares of silva had been felled and cleared, and Lisbu trunks now supported sheets of electrolysis membrane. Hydrogen was rapidly and efficiently stripped from water by sunlight and stored in fuel cells. The sheets also created electricity directly, bilayer technology simple to manufacture from raw organic materials. I lifted the lantern, sniffed at it. Not oil or some other liquid fuel, but an ion discharge coil that flickered much as a flame would. The liquid was a supercharged chemical solution. Pretty, but not efficient. Perhaps it had hung as a decoration outside a house. I had seen no other lanterns, and the town's power had been cut at its source. The fuel cell and transformer shed. Cells, generators, and other heavy equipment had been removed. As had the village's children, apparently. I found no bodies of inhabitants younger than 20. So equipment and children had been stolen, carried downriver, perhaps. The raiders, Bryanists, the woman called them, were hungry for metal. Lamarckia was short of high-quality metal ores, and the immigrants evidently had not gone in for large-scale mining or big smelters. The village's communications center had once occupied a small house 30 meters west of the power shed. The equipment, simple radios judging by the marks and few implements left behind, had been removed. 3 bodies sprawled on the porch. I studied the dark greenhouse and crop fields, 100 hectares of cleared land cut out of the silva. The raiders had left behind a number of wagons but taken the village's electric tractors. That explained the wheel ruts on the gravel road to the dock. They had probably used the tractors to haul the transformers, generators, and other stolen goods from the village. I pictured a wagon full of children, crying and screaming. Teeth clenched harder, I walked to the second dormitory. Inside, the halls were piled high with bodies. Streaks of blood up the walkways and steps showed the course of action taken against Moonrise. Clearly the raiders had meant to torch this building and all the bodies in it. Somehow they had failed to finish their task, leaving the bodies on the quadrangle and in the other dormitory, perhaps in the houses as well. Someone had apparently decided it was more expedient to take the equipment and children and get away before others arrived. Bullets in the trees. Perhaps a few, Larissa, her cousin, Naquano, and the other, had survived the attacks and gone to the docks. I pictured a lone boat left behind to pick off survivors as they came out of the jungle. Or they might have been the first to die as the boats arrived. Then I thought of Naquano's slate. Slates would be valued here. I had found no other slates among the bodies, yet they had left his. That convinced me Naquano, Gennadia, and the other had been killed last. This level of violence was a new thing on Lamarckia. I picked my way through and over the bodies at the end of the hall, keeping my lantern beam high, boots sinking into soft flesh, arms and legs and torsos sliding, chests expelling bizarre moans as they shifted. I refused to look into their blank, rotten fruit faces. My eyes already filled with tears and my stomach spasmed at the extraordinary smell. Never in my life had I been exposed to so much intimate, concentrated death. I climbed to the second floor and leaned against a wall. I could not remember the last time I had felt the need to vomit. The feeling passed. I stood upright again. A sound came from a side room. I stopped, listened, rapped the wall with my knuckles. "Who are you?" a weak male voice responded.
"Oh, kill me and damn you!"
"Are you armed?" I asked. No reply. I got to my hands and knees and placed the lantern in the doorway. Nobody shot at it. I peered around the corner, saw a room filled with crates and boxes, and lying against the boxes, a man. His legs only were visible from where I squatted, pants torn, dried blood caking the cloth. I stood and entered slowly. The man lay with arms spread wide in a pile of books and papers, eyes focused on the ceiling. He appeared to be 75 or 80 years old, hair white, face gaunt with more than age. He clutched a bottle of water and a dark, gnawed piece of something, bread perhaps. I hunkered beside him. The man turned his head into the beam of the lantern, squinted, and said,
"Did you see? Have you brought them?"
"I'm alone," I said. The man reached up and felt my sleeve.
"They left us behind," he said. "Are you a..."
His lips couldn't make the word. "I'm a researcher. I just got here."
"On a boat?"
I shook my head.
"No other boats? No disciplinary?"
"Not yet." "Are you badly hurt?"
"Bad enough,"
the man said.
"I'm going to die. I really need to die."
He had been shot in the chest and arm, and seemed to have been cut across his arms and breast by knives. I could do nothing for him. No water left in the village plumbing, no electricity, no medical supplies. I asked if he could describe his attackers.
"Everything we predicted," the man murmured, shrugging free of my fingers. "Everything I told them."
His lips worked again, managed the word he had been trying for.
"Bryanists, of course. General Bays. Who else?"
"From where?"
"Nearby. Bays sailed from Naderville in Shia and made a base. His ships send boats upriver at night. They lie low during the day. They look for ore and metal and machines. Everything goes east to Shia."
Shia was a massive continent northeast of Elizabeth's Land, across 2,000 kilometers of the Darwin Sea. "Children?" I asked. The man's face wrinkled in distress.
"All," the man said. "Bays wants them for Bryan."
"What's your name?"
"Fitch.
He licked his lips.
Sander Darcy Fitch, a doctor. They took all the medicine, all the equipment.
Why did they kill so many?
Except me, Fitch said.
And a woman.
Who?
Larissa Strick-Cashimo. Even in his pain, he managed to make a face.
Crazy bitch. Her husband thought we could deal with the Bryanists.
Why kill everybody?
Oh, there will be mansions and riches, and Lamarckia will bow to their will.
The man started to sing in an undertone. His eyes shut tight, he rocked back and forth, making the box upon which he leaned creak and rustle. Suddenly he convulsed, then opened his eyes again and reached up to me.
Secret, he said. Very secret.
What?
The Hexamon will come. Do you believe?
It's inevitable, I said.
I have disguises and supplies, old clothes, cast-offs, right here. I run the charity. That's why I hid instead of fighting. I thought they would come, seeing this. They can have their pick. Of course, if they send thousands, not enough.
You've been waiting? I asked.
He's been gone 37 years, Fitch said. He took the clavicle and just went away. Maybe he didn't make it.
Fitch coughed and shuddered again.
Smells so bad. Secret. Please, I have to tell now.
It's all right, I said. The old man reached up, brushed his filth-caked fingers on my face.
Don't know you, or anyone like you, he said, looking me over, my thin shirt and baggy tan pants. You dress the old style, like when we arrived, and you look different.
A light grew in his eyes. His mouth opened wide.
Take these clothes. Yours are all wrong. By the good man, do I make you out of air?
I shook my head. He struggled to rise but fell back, legs kicking like shaken sticks.
Star, fate, and breath, he croaked, licking his lips. Be kind to me. Preserve me from the pride of the hand, stars of all life, to which I will return to be remade, erase my sins.
My eyes moistened again, hearing the old prayer, and I echoed the old man. Together,
and purify, bind my atoms to something higher, send my light far to others who truly see. In the arms of great galaxies there lies salvation, and we there will go to dance in endless joy the innocent dance free of the hand.
The old man's voice faded, and I finished. In the name of the good man, the secrets of Logos, of fate and breath and soul, so be it through deep time.
You,
Fitch said, grasping my arm weakly.
Are you alone?
Tears streamed down my cheeks. Yes, I said.
Take the clothes. Save us from what we've done. May the memory of the good man serve you.
Fitch's breath stopped. Here, that was enough. He was dead. The bottle of water rolled and spilled. I set it upright, then sprinkled water on the old man's face. Free of the hand and its toils, absolution. I kneeled beside the body, lips set tight. After some minutes, I stood, nerves ragged. As Fitch had suggested, I searched through the boxes of old clothes and cast-off goods. I exchanged my new clothes for sturdy, frayed trousers and shirt, but kept my boots. A cloth rucksack served to hold the slate and a few other clothes. Outside, in the courtyard, away from the trails of blood, I smeared my boots with mud. Then I returned to the river. 3. In the east, sun peaked pale yellow between the immense trunks and parasols and fan leaves behind the dock. The woman stirred. She opened her eyes, saw me, and closed them again as if resigned.
Nobody's come, she murmured.
Not yet, I said. Feel better?
I haven't eaten in days.
I'm pretty hungry myself, I said. Is there food anywhere? She shook her head.
They looted the town.
The Bryanists?
Yes.
You're expecting somebody to come. A boat.
I don't know who's alive. Bays sent big boats filled with troops. Maybe they took Calcutta, too. They shot. When the Quano and Ganadia and Ghana...
She lifted her head, jaw thrusting and neck straining at the memory.
Missed me.
Are there any boats nearby? Another village? I asked. She pointed upriver with her nose.
They should have been here yesterday. I waited and they didn't come.
She walked to the shore. I stood and followed. She glanced over her shoulder.
Go away, whoever you are, she said. I'm tired. I'm a dead person.
What's your name? I asked, though I knew already.
Larissa,
the woman said, stopping again, hunching her shoulders as if I were a buzzing insect that might sting. My name is Olmi, I said. I'm from the Triad family of Datchetong.
I've heard of them, Larissa said. Lenk disenfranchised them.
She rubbed her nose and raised her eyes to my face.
I know you're a liar, she said, eyes narrowed. Maybe the Silva made you.
I shook my head.
I'll believe anything now. Nothing matters, she said.
With a shake of her head and a shiver, she led me away from the river, back to the village. I walked beside her. She took each step with a wide-eyed deliberation, forcing herself on. Her lips worked silently.
We're almost there, she said.
The broad red fans and black trunks closed overhead. We walked in shadow. Something, a flying ribbon, darted in front of my face, undulated, stung me on the cheek, flashed away before I could swipe at it. Larissa stared at me listlessly.
Samplers only bite once here. Then Liz knows you.
I wiped a small smear of blood from my cheek. Larissa trudged on. When were you bitten? I asked.
When I was a little girl, I suppose. I forget.
We neared the tower. From the direction of the river came a sound of motors. Larissa slowed, eyes wild, breath coming in jerks. I stopped and took hold of her arm. She looked up at me like a child.
They're back, she said.
Stay here, I'll see, I said. I held her shoulders as if to plant her feet on the spot, but felt sure once I was gone she would run and hide. I returned along the path, looked over my shoulder, saw her standing beside the tower like a stunned animal. By the dock, I hid behind a thick black Lisbu trunk and peered north, downriver. Four small launches moved slowly against the current, their hulls chalk white against the river's dawn gray-blue. Each launch carried 10 or 12 passengers, all in uniform. I frowned. Black dust fell from above, coating like soot. I absently rubbed some between my fingers. It felt fine as rouge and clung to my skin. There was some commotion on the boats. I heard their voices across the water, angry and concerned. The launches were within 100 meters of the dock, and observers in their prows had already seen the bodies. The motors cut back, and the boats edged toward the shore. I saw rifles held at ready. They did not appear to be invading soldiers. Very likely the boats carried police, a disciplinary, and officers from Calcutta. I considered whether to meet them here or at the village. Larissa decided for me. She stepped up behind me and walked onto the dock. Her footsteps echoed on the planks in the morning stillness.
You're late!
She shouted to the boats. A thick-bodied, balding man with a narrow, closely trimmed beard stood in the bow of the leading boat.
Who are you?
He called back. He tossed her a rope and she took it, sidestepping her cousin's body to tie it. She stood, brushing black dust from her hands on her pants, and said in clear, accusing tones,
Why didn't you come earlier?
I stepped from behind the trunk and stood on the dock. The men and women regarded us both warily. All wore uniforms, but of varying colors, some ill-cut. Homemade, I thought, hand-sewn. The balding, bearded man climbed from the first boat.
We didn't get any radio calls for a day and a half. We saw unknown boats going upriver. Raiders, Bryanists, we presumed. The citizen's rank thought maybe a disciplinary should have a look.
He approached, squinting at her.
Larissa, aren't you? Larissa, Strick Kashimu?
What happened here?
They killed us, she answered. Then he came.
She pointed to me. I stepped forward and pulled the pistol from my waistband, holding it by the barrel. "It's hers," I said. The balding man took the pistol and handed it to one of his officers, who placed it in a cloth bag. "My name is Olmi Apdachitong. Elevi Yar Thomas, disciplinary at Calcutta." He did not offer to shake my hand. "I don't recognize you. Where are you from?" he asked. "I've been in the Silva, traveling and studying," I said. "I just arrived." "He's a liar," Larissa confided, as if it might ingratiate her with the older man. He gave her a wary glance, sensing something was not quite right. "Did you see what happened?" he asked me. "No," I said. All but three of the men and women in gray marched along the trail toward the village. One man with a heavy long-barreled rifle stood guard over the boats. The disciplinary examined the bodies on the dock. One woman, short and powerfully built, with auburn hair cut short beneath a loose gray cap, pulled tarps from the boat lockers and spread them beside the corpses. "We didn't bring a doctor," she reminded Thomas. He could not take his eyes from the bodies. His broad, fleshy face showed taut, pale lines. "In the name of the good man, why?"
"Passion," Larissa said, lips curling with hate. "They have a lot of passion."
In the empty village refectory, where all the inhabitants of Moonrise would have sat in communion for lunch and dinner, the disciplinary spun a chair around and sat on it front to back. I sat across from him on the opposite side of a round table.
"You're lucky you weren't involved, aren't you?"
Thomas didn't wait for my answer.
"The whole village had maybe three guns. They've lived peacefully here for 39 years. They had 27 children. All gone. We haven't found a one of them."
Thomas scratched his nose reflectively.
"I've heard Bayes is taking all the children, that the Bryanists want to raise them to think as they do. I hope that's true. They wouldn't just kill them, would they? Take them away and then kill them?"
I shook my head, ignorant.
"You can't tell me anything?" he asked in an undertone.
I summed Thomas up quickly. Chosen by the citizens' rank and heads of triad families of his district to act as chief disciplinary, a kind of constable, the disciplinary would choose new citizen deputies every 3 years, a tradition in the Varicate communes. He had arrived late, I judged, because there would have been nothing he could have done. He had seen the boats, known them for what they were, and... or perhaps I misjudged. "I've only been in the village since yesterday evening," I said. "Larissa says they had a dispute over minerals."
"What do they lack in their zone? An innocuous village, no reason for it to be slaughtered."
124 dead. Thomas's face wrinkled into an ugly scowl, and he seemed ready to spit.
"Not much high-grade ore on Lamarckia, not out in the open. A little here, 10 kilometers through the Silva, just beginning to think about mining it. Brian lusts for metal enough to kill for it. What can we do? We have few weapons."
"Just bury the bodies." Thomas leaned forward.
"The woman calls you a liar. Something's taken a chunk out of your cheek. A sampler?"
I had hoped to have more time to blend in. I could only stick with my story, however thin, and hope to get away in Calcutta. "It wasn't the first time I've been sampled," I said. "I discovered a subzone and spent some time in it, looking for signs of a new flux." Subzones, Red Hill's encyclopedia said, were regions of peculiar specialization within an ecos, where signs of unfamiliar characteristics sometimes emerged. Some scholars speculated that changes in subzones could be harbingers of fluxes. Others maintained subzones were actually small ecoi in themselves, serving specific needs for the larger zones in a symbiotic relationship. I hoped the encyclopedia was not hopelessly out of date. Thomas considered this answer, then shrugged.
"I try to stay out of zone studies. People interest me."
Thomas raised his own slate.
"I have no track on you. Census of 5 years ago. 22,000 of us on Lamarckia, 10,000 on Elizabeth's land. I have no birth records for a man named Olmi of the Datchetong. I do have a record for a Daro Janfima of the Datchetong extended triad. He stole something pretty important, it doesn't say what, 37 years ago. He was never caught, case not pursued.
My respect for the disciplinary jumped several notches. Darrow Janfima was the informer who had returned to the way. I suddenly connected his theft of a clavicle with Larissa's comment that the Datchatong had been disenfranchised. Wrong name, I told myself. They proscribed the whole triad. Thomas rocked on his chair, then stood and pocketed his slate.
I knew Naquano well, an intelligent, kind man. He came to lecture every few months downriver in Calcutta. We found the body of the encyclopedist, Redhill, himself. Did you know he lived here? He put Moonrise on the map, so to speak.
They shot him in the head. Thomas raised his eyes and met mine squarely. He stood.
Quite a few distinguished citizens for so small a village.
I watched him closely, saying nothing.
Time to finish. Bury the bodies and leave. We've recorded the scene. Nothing more I can do now.
The Silva will take over inside a week, said Thomas's second, the tough-faced, stocky woman Bruni.
She stood by the tower and scrutinized the Lisboa trunks and 1 foot of a cathedral tree beyond the pipes. One of her eyelids twitched reflexively. She turned and regarded me curiously, but was leaving all questions to Thomas. I accompanied Thomas and 4 others down to the river. I took 1 end of a stretcher, Thomas the other, and we carried Naquano's body, the last, from the dock. Larissa watched as we approached the other bodies lined up in the quadrangle.
Thank Logos, I have no children, she murmured, falling in step behind.
We all dug 4 long trench graves in the hard-packed soil of the quadrangle, very different from the rich, chunky loam in the Silva. The spades bit into the dead and chalky dirt with short, singing barks. Until arriving in Moonrise, I had never had human mortality shoved in my face with such visceral force and so often. I had never buried anyone before. Conflicts with the Jarts in the way were altogether swifter and more deadly, leaving few traces. The sharp intakes of breath and heavy panting of the men and women working around me, the stamps of defiant individuality on their faces, awoke a hazy, difficult emotion. Horror and pride commingled. I dug with a will. 1 woman stopped to wipe away tears. A man joined her, shovel in hand, arm around her shoulder, and offered her a handkerchief. We finished a trench intended for 30 of the dead. The first was a small, thin body. The tarp was removed, and I saw a woman of perhaps 60 or 70 years, natural years, lived without extraordinary medical assistance or rejuvenation. She had been shot in the neck and chest by a projectile weapon. The wounds looked ugly, purple, and puffy, like old meat. That was what they had made of her, old meat. The woman's swollen brown and purple face seemed rudely, disdainfully peaceful. I looked at my fellow diggers, a strong young man with broad bull shoulders and fat cheeks, the auburn-haired, strong-bodied woman Bruni, slender middle-aged man with a permanently worried expression, a young woman whose face stayed flushed all the time we dug. Individual. No acquiescence to artificial beauty, no reconstruction. The bull-shouldered young man put down his shovel and stared at the dead woman. He seemed reluctant to do what had to be done. I bent and closed the old woman's eyes with 2 fingers. I had once seen that in an entertainment about times long past on distant Earth. The touch of her skin, cold and moist, and the sticky push of her eyelids against sunken eyeballs made my flesh crawl. The young man nodded gratitude and approval. We put the woman into the shroud again, making a sling, and lowered her into the grave. Others arranged more bodies. Young men, old men, 2 more older women. They lowered the other bodies into the hole. Working in sync, we filled in the grave. I observed the faces around me, grim, eyes a little wild, some dream dying inside. Sunset. The quadrangle bathed in orange light from a passing cloud, glorious in the sun. Dusk loomed when we finished. Thomas spoke a few words from the prayer of common place over the rows of long graves. Others finished their lists and maps of what remained of the village. A female officer conferred with Thomas about a list of missing children taken from records in the mayor's office. Then Thomas took me back to the tower.
He pulled a bar of sweetened gum from his coat pocket, broke it in half, offered half to me, and I took it, interested in maintaining a friendly connection with this man. We climbed the tower and looked down on the darkening Silva and village, the empty buildings and houses, the pale tan scars of fresh graves in the grayish-brown quadrangle, the small greenhouse farm and large tanks, paddles motionless inside brown sewage, no longer converting waste directly to food. I could not see the dock, but the far bank of the river was visible. Parasols and fans folded and furled, withdrawing for the night. A cloud of black dust shot up from the Silva 100 meters off, drifted. I smelled citrus and spice. "Tell me more about why you're here," Thomas said. "I came here to catch a riverboat. I've spent much of my life the last few years alone in the Silva. I'm not used to violence. I don't know what more I can do or say." Thomas rubbed his balding head with a chalky hand. "I said years ago citizens should be forced to carry papers." He lifted his eyebrows and glared at the horizon. "Oh, no, not that," he mimicked. "This is a place where we can all be free. We'll take you to Calcutta. You'll tell what you know to the Committee of Citizens rank. If you're one of the Bryanists, and they left you here by accident, or left you here to spy, I'll personally see you to a full citizen trial in Athenae." There was nothing I could say. I did not need to sleep. No one wanted to sleep in the buildings. I lay with the others in one corner of the quadrangle, where no bodies had fallen and the soil was not stained with blood, under the broad clear sky tracing patterns in the stars. The double oxbow was not visible. Now the sky was marked by tiny puffs of dim color, purples and pinks, the shrouds of dead suns. I felt a dizzying moment of complete disorientation. These stars probably occupied the same universe, but not necessarily the same galaxy or even the same period of time. In the ways geometry stacks, distance and time could become as tangled as an infinity of threads tossed into a box. I was among humans, but that gave little comfort. If I died here, who would know me well enough to connect the thread of my pneuma to any comprehensible past? The burial and service had moved me more profoundly than I thought possible. I had largely abandoned my spiritual beliefs since joining Way Defense, concentrating on a different kind of personal development, devotion to concept, to large-scale social and not metaphysical issues, devotion to fighting off the menace of the Jarts, devils beyond the conception of any human before the opening of the way. Now I faced a much smaller problem, but more personal and challenging to the point of almost certain defeat. What I saw in the stars now were the faces of my mother and father and all they stood for suddenly become diseased, wrong. Not many slept that night, however tired. The boats prepared to depart at dawn. They would move much more quickly with the river current, but it would still take a day to get back to Calcutta. I listened to the officers talking among themselves. They had segregated me at the stern of the last boat, leaving me 2 meters of space as if I were a pariah. No family, no known origin, rumors passing quickly. Monkeys shying from a stranger to the communal tree. I felt a brief flash of anger at their stupidity, then wondered what I would do in their place. Before Thomas could give the order to leave, however, we all heard the distant sound of another small engine. Larissa, in the cabin of the largest boat, let out a sharp wail and struggled, pushing aside the startled men and women around her. She leaped ashore with surprising dexterity and ran up the road to the village. The few deputies who had rifles lifted them, aiming them upriver where the sounds came. A single 8-meter launch was drifting downriver with the current, its internal combustion engine idling, bow cutting through swaths of morning fog. In the launch, 2 men squatted at stern and prow, both staring at the 4 boats arranged around the dock and shore. Neither of them appeared to be armed. The disciplinary came aft and stood beside me to get a better view of the boat. "It's Randall," he said. "Erwin Randall and someone else. Matthew Shatrow, I think."
Thomas seemed to know everyone on the river. He ordered the rifles lowered. "They're not Bryanists, they're researchers." He shouted to the crew of his second boat, "Go get that woman, damn her!" The launch came alongside, and a tall, loose-limbed man with a thin face and long nose and somber brown eyes waved to Thomas, adding a half-hearted flick of the hand to the others. "What happened here?" he asked. "Dead," Thomas said. "Fate and breath," Randall said. Shatrow at the rear frowned and drew up his jacket collar. "All of them?" "All but the missing," Thomas said. "There are 7 boats upriver," Randall said, pointing. "They must be the ones. 3 flatboats. They didn't even bother shooting us." "Good to see you're healthy," Thomas said without irony. "I passed a radio message down to Calcutta," Randall said. He ran his hand through thick, straw-colored hair. "You know Matthew Shatrow, my assistant. We've been surveying Liz up to Lake Mariotis." Thomas seemed in a quandary and not happy to see these men. He stood with foot on the lead boat's gunwale, glanced at me with a puzzled expression, and then looked to his boats and deputies. "They came past Calcutta at night. They must have a base somewhere. We should go after them. We passed a camp on the way down. They're about 30 kilometers upriver by now, and the camp's empty. Everything's cleared out. I think they'll make a run downriver in the next few days." "If I know where they are, then we must respond," Thomas sounded regretful. Randall sympathized. "They're all armed, over 50 men and women." "We'll go with you." He held out his empty arms. "But without guns, we're not much use." "No need for that," Thomas said. "I have 2 people who need to get downriver. This man here, his name is Olmi Apdachatong, and a woman from the village. She's been through a lot, and she's easily frightened. Her name is Larissa Strick-Cashimu." "I know of her," Randall said. He nodded to me and fixed me with a curious stare. Everybody knew everybody, and I did not fit in. "Can you take them to Calcutta and deliver them to the citizens' rank for depositions?" Randall's eyes, it seemed, would permanently record all that was important. "Of course," he said. Shatrow, a well-muscled short fellow with pale skin and cropped blonde hair, began to rearrange boxes and bags in the launch. Randall and Thomas stood awkwardly in their boats, both realizing that the news had put Thomas and his deputies into a quandary. As disciplinary, Thomas had a duty to confront the attackers. Yet a small party such as this, armed with only 8 rifles and a few pistols, would not do well against such opposition. Randall's face grew red and he stammered, "I don't think it would be a good idea for you to take them on." Thomas coughed and waved a hand. "That's my decision," he said. "We'll call downriver and ask for more boats, and for citizens to be on the lookout. Nobody wants them to get away after all they've done on the north coast. They can't sneak so many boats past us if we're watching night and day." "They may divide their forces and send their stolen goods down first," Randall said. One of the flatboats was heavy in the water. "Loaded with tractors and scrap metal," Thomas surmised. He shook his head sharply, not wanting to hear news that would make him angrier or fix him more firmly in his duty. "Pull your launch in and take these people, and we'll be on our way." Larissa returned to the dock in the firm arms of 2 women. Thomas explained the situation to her, and she listened with little bird-like nods, eyes wide. We climbed into Randall's boat, and I thanked Thomas for all he had done. "I've done nothing for you," Thomas said a little coldly. "When you get to Calcutta, tell the truth and tell them what I'm doing here. If nobody sends help, or even if they do, we may not come back. I'm not asking for pity. It's just the damned truth." The deputies in the boats stared at us owlishly as we pulled away and headed downriver. Shatrow unfolded a rough blanket for Larissa, and Randall took the tiller, pushing us out to the middle, avoiding a few river vine humps. The bottom of the boat was filled with boxes packed with glass jars. The jars contained chunks of mottled tissue, specimens. "You weren't in Moonrise when it happened, then?" Randall asked. I shook my head. Larissa began to chatter nervously, telling the 2 men all she had told Thomas and me, and adding her suspicions that I was a liar. Randall listened intently, but did not seem to share her concern or disapproval. The banks of the river revealed an immense monotony of silva, with little change in color or elevation. Red and black, browns and purples, no green. Tens of kilometers from the banks, mountains rose, and silva balloons clustered along the base of the mountains. But from this distance, 100 meters from either shore, I could see little more than black trunks, parasols, and fans, and the legs and pink crowns of cathedral trees. The river smelled of pure fresh water, bland but invigorating. Peering into the dark clarity, I saw dappled silver blurs move, flash, and undulate us. Redhill's encyclopedia said that creatures of Petain's Zone, Zone 5, dominated the Terra Nova to its roots deep in Elizabeth's Land. Some of the riparian scions were as large as whales, easily capable of toppling a boat. A picture showed a sinuous monstrosity 20 meters in length, crude eyes arrayed in a cross on its flat forehead, blunt tusks mounted on nose, no mouth. Its function within the river, its use to the Zone 5 ecos, was not known. I imagined such a thing sliding beneath our boat in the deep blue water, and actually enjoyed the shiver I felt. Awe at nature was a much cleaner emotion than any I had been feeling lately. Larissa fell asleep, head lolling with mouth open. Randall sat on a bench beside me, letting Shatro take the tiller, and offered me a bar of gum. Chewing gum seemed quite the habit here. "Sir Cashamu is known up and down the river," Randall said in a low voice. "A loud and foolish woman. If her husband left her to go to Shia, he may have had better reason than most." He confided a wry grimace. "What were you doing in the Silva?" "I've always wanted to do research," I said. Science was a word rarely used by divaricates. I've spent the last 2 years studying on my own. I felt very vulnerable with this man. He probably knew more about the Silva than anyone on the river, and certainly more than I could have gleaned from Jan Fema, the Dalgesh Report, and Redhill's Encyclopedia. It's not been easy. I should have studied more before going into the Silva. Randall chuckled. Very likely. Did you really get sampled? The small prick on my cheek had almost healed. She says I did. Something flying struck me in the dark and drew blood. But Liz doesn't do that twice, does she? No, Randall said. He smiled and went aft to rig a shade for the woman. Left to myself with nothing to do but study the river and the endless silva, I took out Naquano's slate and resumed my study. I still could not access the scholar's personal records, but judging from clues left in several small open files, Naquano had used a few key words that he changed every few months. I wondered who he thought would read his private documents. I could not put the right words together yet, but all his public references were open to me. As we drifted downriver, I searched for a history and found several, all unfinished, all with the hallmarks of enthusiastic amateurs. The immigrants had come here 37 Lamarckian years before, emerging from a gate near the present site of Calcutta. Lenk named their landfall, its measure then unknown, after his wife Elizabeth. They had been woefully unprepared. It took months to sort out Lamarckia's possible contributions to diet and the need for raw materials. For the first 10 years, starvation was a major problem. I punched through dozens of stills of gaunt, hollow-eyed settlers clearing Lisbu scions, planting grains and fruit trees and vines, toppling cathedral trees for their strong, light, woody trunks. Lenk's recordists made videos of determined mothers and fathers carrying the first children born on Lamarckia, babies wrapped in worn cloth, parents in rags. Among the 2,000 had been 7 doctors, with less than a ton of medical supplies, little of it advanced. Here, Lenk had insisted on doctrinal purity. Some apparently had ignored or interpreted his instructions, but not enough to avert serious medical problems, including fatal allergic reactions to certain scions. Hungry, desperate people had eaten many things without going through proper procedures. The faces in the pictures and movies haunted me. Gaunt, frightened but steadfast, sure of themselves. All Thistledown's citizens regarded themselves as pioneers and explorers.
but Lenk's people had embarked on an adventure qualitatively different from Thistledown's journey, and with far less chance of success. Along the banks on both sides, black and brown pipes several meters wide reached down to the river, mouths half submerged. Booming, sucking sounds came across the water. Enormous organic pumps at work, drawing water from the river and transporting it inland. Every few kilometers we passed these pipes, part of Liz's immense hydraulic system, circulating water for all of her scions. 10 hours into the journey, Randall divided a loaf of bread between the four of us. "Wine?" he asked, offering a small ceramic jug. Larissa ate her bread in delicate nibbles, staring at the far shore, but refused the wine, scooping water from the river instead. I accepted a cup. The wine was heavy and sweet, with a bitter aftertaste. I carefully did not make a face. Randall, focused on my reaction, seemed dissatisfied. "You didn't say where you studied, though I assume at Jakarta, since that's where most of the Dachatongs have lived since Lenk brought us here." "I studied independently," I said. Randall squinted. "I'm as fond of Liz as anyone, but I can't imagine being alone in the Silva for years. I'd go slaps. What was it like?" "Hard," I said. I grinned. "I almost did go slaps." "You're a cautious man, Sir Olmi." "Being alone does it," I said. He shaded his eyes, searching the overgrown banks. "There are a couple of camps along here. Prospectors, small crop farmers, gatherers. Characters. I promised to look in on one. Kimon Georgios is his name. He likes being alone, too." I followed Randall's gaze to the western bank. The Lisbu arborids were hung with orange sausage-shaped pods as much as 2 meters long, dangling over the water like a thickly tasseled fringe. Through the fringe I saw a pale brown smudge hidden among the shiny black trunks. "Is that a house?" I asked. Randall rose to a crouch, hands on his knees, and murmured, "Yes." "Sharp eyes, Olmi." The boat pushed slowly into a narrow branch of the main river. Amid Lisbu and thick clumps of phytids, 5 cathedral trees surrounded a small clearing. An elegantly crafted small house stood in the clearing. Hinged window covers raised on stakes propped up in the dirt gave it the appearance of an old, crippled bird trying valiantly to fly. Shrill whistling broke out on the opposite shore and was taken up by the Silva around the house. The sound bothered neither Randall nor Shatro, so I did not act surprised either. Randall hailed the house. No one answered. He gestured for Shatro to take us in closer. We pushed up onto the bank beside the clearing. "Georgios has been up and down this river for years," Randall said. "He knows it better than anyone. Someone looking for a guide, like Janos Strick." He didn't finish his thought. We stepped off the prow and walked up the bank, listening to whistles echo back into the depths of the Silva. Larissa stayed under the shade Randall had rigged, peering out at us like a small frightened animal. Randall and Shatro walked around the house, and Randall called Giorgio's name. Still no answer. Randall entered the house through the front door. A startled curse was followed by a relieved chuckle. A scion the size of a cat, tubular red body mounted on 3 long, thin legs, stalked through the front door with slow dignity, pointed what might have been its head at the shore and the boat, and turned to walk into the jungle. Randall came out of the house, shaking his head. "He's been gone for days. Liz is starting to move in." He climbed into the launch. Shatro and I pushed the boat off the bank and climbed in after him. Randall took the tiller and guided us back to the middle of the main body of the river. Randall nodded, as if keeping time with some inner tune. "He'd have shut the house up if he'd left voluntarily. Never left it open for long legs. He's well known on the river. Everyone knows he's the best guide upstream." Larissa shouted, "They took him!" Her voice rang across the river and was met with more high whistling from both shores. "If they were smart, they probably did," Randall said. Shatro sat in the bow and said little, but scanned the river constantly. 12 kilometers from Calcutta, the banks of the Terra Nova grew in height and narrowed to form a deep gorge only 50 meters wide. The launch rushed through the gorge with thrilling speed. Randall took the tiller, and we avoided the few rocks and quick broad eddies without mishap. I observed large pink parasols waving like huge hands on the rims of the gorge. Black and electric blue creepers hung down the sheer, mist-shiny black walls, pulsing as they pumped water from the river to the Silva above. After several kilometers, the walls dropped again, and we passed through low, flat countryside, populated by thick canopies of lisbu and punctuated by the ubiquitous cathedral trees.
"Did you see any heliophiles this far south?" Randall asked.
We had been quiet since leaving the deserted cabin, and he seemed to want to break the grim mood. I did not know what heliophiles were, so I shook my head.
"Some years they travel south of Moonrise, but I haven't seen them recently. They're taking a different role in Liz's scheme, I think. You must have relied on Diospyros."
"Kept me alive most of the time," I said. "Edible after soaking in water and cooking, high in usable proteins and sugars, sweet and meaty to the taste, Diospyros had been one of the first phytids used successfully for food. If Randall was testing me, however, he would soon catch me up."
"Did you see White Hat feeding on Diospyros?"
"No," I said. "I saw them sucking on lisbu."
"That's their habit this far north. South of here, where we haven't depleted them, they seem to prefer Diospyros."
Randall seemed satisfied with this, and kept silent for the next few kilometers. The sun felt good on my hands as I clasped the launch's gunwale. Much of the time the sky was veiled by thin, high, ice-crystal clouds, diffusing the sun's hot disk into an incandescent pearl. I shifted forward and leaned back, closing my eyes in the bright, milky glare. My neck muscles had bunched with something. Tension, I supposed. I could not remember having felt tense in years, if ever. The implants and supplements I had given up for this mission had smoothed so many of my body's basic reactions. I seemed to be experiencing a new kind of existence, or at least one largely forgotten. My vision blurred and I drifted into a musing doze, also a novel experience. I jerked and lifted my head, blinking at a shadow leaning over me. Shatro handed me a tin of biscuits. He spoke softly, diffidently.
"We'll see Calcutta in an hour."
The river broadened, and the current slowed again. Larissa came out from under the shade and sat well apart from me, staring at nothing in particular but away from the boat, lips pursed, brows elevated as if in unending surprise. On Thistledown, her family would take her in for a mental refresh. Even Devaricates recognized mental dysfunction. Randall joined me with his own tin of biscuits.
"You've not heard much news recently, then?"
I liked Randall, felt that he was sympathetic, but I was not looking for more conversation. I needed much more time to study, to avoid being caught up in stupid mistakes. "Yes," I said. "I apologize for my ignorance." He smiled and shook his head.
"The political situation has changed since you left Calcutta?"
"Calcutta," I said.
"Passed through Moonrise?"
"On my way upriver, yes."
"Bryan sent his dogs out to savage the north coast last year. They've ransacked 7 villages and stolen everything they could get their hands on, including children."
"Why take children?" Shatro asked, shaking his head.
"It doesn't figure. A hungry community stealing children?"
"They may not be hungry anymore if the stories are to be trusted."
"We don't talk with Naderville much now," Randall said. "Somebody in Naderville may have made some calculations and realize we'll outstrip them in population and influence in the next generation. Their women are exhausted and they can't make their baby machines work. Stealing kids in populations as small as ours makes sense if you can feed and raise them."
I had heard nothing about baby machines. Naquano's references did not mention them either. The Varicates had never believed in ex utero gestation and birth. "Nobody's fought back?" I asked. Randall gave me one of his appraising looks. "Lenk doesn't seem to have the stomach for a war. I think he hopes Naderville will just fade away. But they've regained a lot of strength in the last year. Of course, when they communicate with us at all, they publicly disavow General Bayes, but he delivers his goods to Naderville all the same." We sat in silence for a moment. Then Randall said,
Do you have any place to stay in Calcutta?
Hospice, I said. No money.
No need to stay in hospice. Why not stay with my family while you wait to testify? Might be a couple of days.
Thanks, I said. I'm not very presentable. I've been on my own for so long.
We've been down south on the Terra Nova for the last 2 weeks, Randall said. I'm sure you've seen interesting things, even if you don't know how to interpret them. There aren't enough researchers on this planet that we can afford not to talk to each other.
6 kilometers above Calcutta, the geology changed abruptly. The land became bumpy and rugged. The silva thinned, leaving cathedral trees and a few scattered lisbus rising like game markers on a low rolling carpet of vivid purple and sky blue. Pale gray granite hills rose to the west, capped by thick violet phytids.
Look at the color on the hills this spring, Randall said. Brightest I've seen in many years. Wonder if Liz has changed a specification or two.
Shatrow examined the hills through a pair of binoculars. He saw my interest and loaned them to me. I looked at the hills, a clump of lisbu 200 meters from the bank, and saw a group of two-necked cleaners working on the arborist's parasols and fans. Their eyeless heads swept from leaf to leaf with slow, sure motions, reminding me both of dinosaurs and microscopic tardigrades. I returned the binoculars to Shatrow.
Sir Randall and I found 7 more varieties of lisbu, all specialized to different mineral conditions, Shatrow said. We've been measuring oxygen production in the deep silva.
Impressive, I said.
Elementary, really, Randall said. Lenk gave us a commission to make sure Liz isn't headed toward another flux. The silva really isn't an important source of oxygen. Negligible, actually. Most of it comes from the coastal oceans. Dissociation of water, we presume, though we don't know. But oxygen levels in the silva could point to changes in the scion mix. It's important work, but rather dull.
I began to wonder how long I could hold out in conversation as a visitor in Randall's house without being unveiled as a complete fraud. I wondered when the Bryanists would return to Moonrise and stake their claim. Would the disciplinary or the citizens of Calcutta oppose them? I tried to imagine this Bryan, about whom there was nothing in Redhill. An ambitious, petty dictator, I guessed, clothed in a ridiculous uniform.
Shatrow cut the motor, and the launch drifted with the stream. Breezes carried unfamiliar scents, tomato juice, ginger. From the south, upriver, I heard the thin, flat whine of more motors. 3 large flat-bottom boats were gaining on us. Clutching a half-eaten biscuit, Randall stepped aft and stared at them. With disgust, he crumpled the biscuit and threw it between the thwarts.
"Here they come, the bold bastards," he growled.
Soon the 3 boats were less than 100 meters away. Uniformed men crowded their decks, perhaps 100 in all. Each flatboat was about 15 meters long and 6 or 7 across the beam, with shallow drafts and long, wide cabins large enough to store farm and other equipment. No women were visible on deck. They would all be back home, I thought, rearing more children for Brian. The men standing around the cabins were mostly brown, a few blacks and whites, the familiar thistle-down mix. They wore tan trousers and loose-fitting white shirts. Most carried their large rifles prominently. Some smiled and talked in low voices as the boats passed the launch. The rest said nothing and just stared at us, rifles poised.
"What do you know about a village upriver called Moonrise?" Randall called to the boats.
His face reddened as he got no answer. Larissa retreated to the shade and lay down, covering her face with her hands. A slight restless milling on the flatboats. We were very close. They could kill us all if they chose.
"What about a citizen named Georgios? Kimon Georgios?"
The boats motored ahead of us. We faced the men on the rear, faces young and old, all indifferent.
"Where are the rest of you?" Randall called, a little foolishly, I thought.
We sat waiting for an answer, but nobody replied in words. Instead, the men on the boats lifted their rifles and pointed them just over our heads, teeth shining behind the glistening black barrels. A high, ululating shout rose from the boats. The men lifted their hands and rifles and sang out again, voices echoing from the edge of the silva.
The gray boat's harmonizing electric whines sounded like a leftover taunt.
"They're going to pass through Calcutta in broad daylight and ahead of us," Shotrow said.
"We're about 6 kilometers south of Calcutta," Randall said. "Won't even talk with us." Absolute contempt, the bastards.
The Silva grew lush again, Lisbu with fringes of pods packed thick along both sides.
On the northern bank, a glistening black sand beach pushed into the Silva and along the river. A party of picnickers lazed over their midday meal, watching us. The men waved politely. They might have waved at the gray boats as well. They did not seem concerned. 3 naked children splashed in the river, their musical shouts and screams rising above the liquid lapping of the river against the boat hulls. I wondered if the children had been called in to hide when the flatboats passed. Everybody seemed unconcerned, relaxed. I dropped one arm over the side and dabbled my fingers. The water was cold, but not bone-chilling. Before I could react, a silvery creature the size of a small trout swifted from the depths and plunged something sharp into my thumb. Jerking, clamping my jaw to still a startled yelp, I yanked my hand out, sucked away a drop of blood, and wiped the thumb quickly on my dark socks. A prick, nothing more. Nobody had noticed. I thought, the river knows me as well now. The sky gleamed like old polished silver at zenith, bluing only above the horizon. Farther downriver, buildings appeared in more clearings, closely attended by Lisbu. Boathouses, some sort of small factory with smoke pouring from a thin black stack, and men marching across a clearing in black aprons, loading wagons. I saw only a few tractors, and of course there would be no horses or oxen. The Lenk group had brought no animals with them. A small farm nestled between the walls of Lisbu like a brown postage stamp on red and purple and black paisley. Silos, but no barns. Out of place, my mind said, but it actually looked quite lovely, familiar in my gut, though I had never seen such a thing in actual experience. I imagined fields of crops, grain and vegetables, biomass ponds, inland, away from the river, perhaps scattered between or spread across the low plateaus northeast of Calcutta, as Redhill described. Human intrusions that Liz apparently tolerated. As we passed the farm, a young man in blue and brown workits, overalls of an ancient cut, came out on a small dock and waved to us. Randall and Shatrow returned his wave.
"There's a reception downriver above Calcutta," the young man shouted, his voice cracking with youth and excitement. "I'd pull in and wait it out."
"What kind of reception?" Randall asked.
"Enough said. You might be spies."
Randall shook his head and waved his thanks for the slender warning, but we did not pull in.
"A reception?" Shatrow asked nervously.
"I think he means Calcutta isn't going to let the flatboats pass," Randall said.
"What can they do?"
"I'd like to find out." Shatrow started to object, but shut his mouth and lowered his head. Randall stood at the bow, glaring downriver. We all listened. Larissa moaned beneath the shade.
"We should land the woman," Shatrow said.
Randall did not seem to hear him.
"Perhaps Serolmi would like to get out too," Shatrow added.
I shook my head. I was as curious as Randall to see what sort of response the town might mount. A few shots like snapping sticks sounded down the river. We all jumped as one. Randall told Shatrow to bring the launch about and run the motor at quarter speed, letting us drift with the current but more slowly. An island covered with pure black Lisbu split the Terra Nova 0.5 kilometer ahead.
"That's where I would do it," Randall said.
"Which way, right or left?"
"I would take my flatboats around both sides," I said.
"Both sides flow deep," Randall said. "But the best side is to the east, left. It's the widest. A lazy, self-assured pilot would go to the left. And that's where I put my pickets and lay my traps. The Bryanists are arrogant bastards, Serolmi. They think they know more than we do. They think we've become sheep." More white-spaced shots, then a steady series of crack, 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 frantic shouting, a boom. A puff of smoke rose above the trees, whirling. "Left!" Randall called out, and Shatro turned the tiller to veer us east of the island. In the Silva along the left bank, men and women stood peering downriver, talking. Some waved and grinned like fools as we passed. Others shouted warnings.
"Skirmish ahead! Pull in!"
Randall shook his head and ignored them. Shatro was becoming more and more agitated, sweat standing out on his pale face. He stared grimly forward with his pale blue eyes, as if expecting the boat to be swallowed. We rounded a stand of Lisbu on a narrow sand spit. Randall increased the turns on the motor. At less than a kilometer an hour, we descended toward the three Bryanist flatboats. Nets and ropes had been strung across the river, and the flatboats were caught in them. Men had been pulled off into the water by the ropes and swam around their boats, heads bobbing in the current. One man hung from a sagging rope, feet dragging in the river, dead. On the eastern bank, shots rang out from behind cover of small shacks and Lisbu trunks. The men on the flatboats were returning fire as best they could, but they were exposed, and more of them were falling to the deck or into the water. The air filled with more cries and shouting. From the shore came war whoops and more shots. A sizzling pipe bomb flew over the river and bounced on the deck of the leftmost flatboat, rolled into the water and exploded, sending up a plume of spray. Another landed squarely on the cabin, rolled to the starboard side, blew up, and propelled a cloud of splinters high into the air. Yet a third landed on the middle boat, and a man plucked it up to toss it away. It exploded in his hand, and his arm and head vanished. On the shore, mingled cries of horror and cheers met this sight, and more cheers as the headless body crumpled and slid off the deck. I felt a sick excitement. My stomach knotted and I clenched sweaty hands. I smelled gunpowder and burning and something else. I presumed it was blood. My skin crawled and my throat closed and I choked at the thought of breathing the vapor of somebody else's blood. All three flatboats were hopelessly caught. From their decks now came cries of surrender, and a few men stood with hands raised, throwing their weapons into the water.
"No quarter!"
someone bellowed from the shore, no doubt a student of history. Shots continued, but fewer in number. The rightmost of the flatboats was taking on water and listing badly. Other sounds came to us, muffled, like trapped animals crying out. Randall stood in the bow, brow creased. "Fates and breath," he said. "There are prisoners in that boat."